So hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Changemakers LA podcast presented by LISC Los Angeles. The Changemakers LA podcast is a tribute to the people and the policies that make LA neighborhoods good places to live, work, and play. I'm Alexandra Dawson, Director of Lending and Investments at the Local Initiative Support Corporation here in Los Angeles. And on today's episode, we will talk with our guests about how they're addressing the equity gap through public policy efforts. Joining us today, we have Constantine Hatcher, who is the Senior Director of Community Impact at California YIMBY. California YIMBY's mission is to make California an affordable place to live, work, and raise a family. Their goal is to put California on a path of broad-based economic prosperity, creating vibrant, livable, and inclusive communities for everyone. Thank you for joining us today, Constantine. We also have with us Maria Casillas, who is the founder and executive leader of Pride and Truth, guiding the organization's strategy to center those most impacted by unjust systems. With a background as a formerly incarcerated person and a first-generation immigrant and single mother, Maria brings a unique perspective to the role. She serves on the board of the Youth Justice Coalition and advocates for the rights of youth, incarcerated individuals, and undocumented people. Welcome, Maria. And finally, we have Alan Greenlee, the Executive Director of the Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing, or SCAMP, where he has served since 2012. With 25 years of experience, he has a strong commitment to helping low-income families, and he has designed and managed programs nationwide, impacting hundreds of thousands of families. His extensive experience allows him to bring innovation to the fight against poverty. So welcome and thank you all for being here with us today. So we're going to jump into questions. And today we're talking about public policy. So public policy is often overlooked, but plays a critical role in the lives of Angelenos. Our guests, you all, are working to bring attention to critical issues and advocate for equitable public policies that impact the most vulnerable populations in our region. You all focus on areas such as homelessness, incarceration, workforce development, and immigration reform, and engage affected communities to be involved in decision-making at local, state, and federal levels. Let's talk about your efforts in raising awareness for public policy and achieving equity for marginalized populations. So the first question is for you, Maria. Maria, as an organizer, you're on the front lines of advocating for reforms to the justice system statewide. Here at home in LA County, you are deeply involved with the Measure J campaign, which sets the foundation to reimagine the systems in Los Angeles. You've spoken about how your lived experience is a source of motivation that guides your work. How does your lived experience inform your advocacy, and in what ways has it guided your policy work so far?
Yes, thank you for such an important question. If I can take it back to when I was raising my two boys and being formerly incarcerated, it was a really challengeful time because statistically, there's over 70,000 barriers that a person faces after incarceration. And that's not even counting the fact that there's a big factor of homelessness, right? So even with the little help that we did have, we still couldn't manage to sustain, let alone raise two children by myself. So that was just the beginning of realizing that there was a huge problem, right? Not mentioning that there's already a problem in the criminal justice system as it is. So if we really look at it, the root of this whole problem starts within the criminal justice system, the court system, our communities not having enough services where our youth and our people that are impacted can get services to really move on with their lives and have a better opportunity. So at the beginning, I didn't quite understand like where the problem was at, But now being so fully invested in doing the work, I understand that the problem, it's at the beginning of the root, right? If our communities would have the support that is needed, then we wouldn't have so much issues, right, in the streets of LA. I mean, over the years, we've seen a lot of homelessness come up to the percentages, incredible percentages. And one of the things that I saw me struggling was maintaining my home, maintaining the rent, you know, being able to house my children. And little by little that I started taking workshops and realizing, like, how can I help? You know, I've been in these shoes. I'm experiencing this by my own life. How can I help? So today we realized that, you know, we need to help with intervention, with diversion, with mental health, with homelessness, because if we don't attack the problem from the beginning, then there's no way that we can stop the top, right? So yeah, that's where I feel like my experiences have really helped me develop the nonprofit organization that I have, so that I can be able to help along with our volunteers and our people that are standing behind us in the community itself that want to make changes in their communities together. Like, we want to make sure that we have a chance, right? So as we moved along, you know, now I realized that it's such a bigger beast, right? So we cannot sit here and think like, oh, this is going to happen overnight. But if a lot of organizations and a lot of people that have been in those shoes, if we all get together and work with the county, then just maybe we'll have a shot at making sure that our future generations have what we needed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And you're right, these are not things that can easily just be tackled in silos. It takes the work of a community to pull together and address the root causes of the issues that our communities are facing. Turning to you, Alan, Measure ULA was drafted by homeless service providers, housing nonprofits, labor unions, and renters' rights groups. Speaking of bringing people together, how were you able to achieve alignment across so many stakeholder groups?
Well, first of all, thanks for the question, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this discussion today. To answer your question specifically, our coalition was able to succeed because we followed five basic steps. And we acknowledge that coalition work is hard, that all the members need to be committed to the hard discussions that you need to have, and then also be committed to the work over the long haul. So the five components, I think, of the coalition were, first of all, we had a alignment of agreement, and it was really based on two principles. One was that we wanted to keep vulnerable, low-income people in their homes if we could. And the second thing we wanted to do was generate resources sufficient to produce significant amounts of affordable housing. We had a very special emphasis in the production side around innovation. So we don't only fund traditional affordable housing the way we build it today, but we also had four other components of the measure on the production side that looked at learning from our experience and encouraging the city to engage in innovative techniques. The second component was that the coalition needs to trust each other. Most of the ULA coalition members had worked together on different ballot initiatives like Measure J, for example, and other things going back to 2016. And in fact, individuals probably at different organizations had worked together even before that. But the idea was that we knew each other and we trusted each other. The third component was that coalition work just takes time. It took us about a year to write the measure. And we also realized in those really difficult and tough discussions that nobody was going to get 100% of everything they wanted. So we needed to be able to willing to negotiate in good faith, to hold on to our values and make sure that our values were incorporated in the measure understanding again that we weren't going to get, everybody wasn't going to get everything that they wanted. The fourth component was that we wanted to focus on winning. So each of the coalition partners was 100% committed to the work and to the campaign. And we created areas of work that allowed for each of the organizations to make a contribution based on their own capacities. So there was not only their ability, people to engage by doing work that they understood and could do well, but there was also room for organizations to stretch and build their own capacity. And I think it's fair to say that all of the coalition members are better off, better able to do the work that they do today because of the work they did on the campaign. And then the final thing to say is that, as sad as I am to say that, the work's not over after Election Day. So you might win, but what we realized over the course of the holidays and the early part of the year was that the coalition needed to stay together to make sure that our values and our point of view was represented when the city started to implement the program. And so we continue to work just as hard today as we did during the campaign.
Thanks, Alan. I love that you mentioned that actually going through this process created stronger organizations at the end of the day. It built on their capacities to do the work that they're already doing. So that's maybe was an unexpected benefit out of all of that, all of the work that you're continuing to do on this. So turning to Constantine, between 2015 and 2020, developers spent upward of $52 billion on affordable housing development in the state of California, with the majority of resources going toward white-led firms. California YIMBY advocated for AB 2873, which presents a unique opportunity for the state to invest in construction and construction-adjacent professional services in firms led by people of color. What type of impact will AB 2873 have, and why is this legislation important?
Thank you so much, Alex. First off, thanks for having me. Really appreciate that I get to be in a discussion with all the folks here. Just everyone's doing such amazing work. And Maria, just want to uplift, really appreciate you sharing your personal story. Very, very powerful. I think, so what I'll do is I'll probably start with the second question in terms of why it's so important. And I think for us, and really also appreciate LISC leadership and really bringing this idea to the forefront, is that, you know, for us, it starts with our values, right? And if we're looking at trying to create vibrant, inclusive, great communities with access, you know, to great schools and great services and great transportation, we have to look at the problem holistically and look at, we can't just look at, you know, that housing as just how do we provide people housing is a key component, but without also looking at what are some of the causal factors of why we got to this in the first place. And we're talking about, you know, racist zoning laws and, deed restriction, specific government policies that have exacerbated this issue and really set communities of color behind, creating things like that have been some of the causal factors of racial wealth gaps. And so, you know, we really wanted to, it's important for us that we're also looking, not just looking at how do we get people housed and, but without looking at how do we use the built environment to create financial opportunities for those that have been on the front lines and the most affected by the housing crisis, our communities of color. And so part of that is where they've been locked out. And here's a clear case of where, you know, people of color, just like you mentioned, have been locked out of this process of billions of dollars in terms of, you know, of wealth creation, in terms of critical jobs, in terms of money that can flow into communities and really change lives and outcomes. And so that was kind of the basis of why we felt this is so important and thinking, looking at how, what can we do here and how can we, you know, make some positive change. So I think the key thing is with AB 2873, it really starts affordable housing builders to really look at one, to incentivize them to really look at how they can diversify the pipeline, the folks that they use to build the housing that, quite frankly, oftentimes is meant to benefit these our communities, right? And so forcing them to have to first report who they're using in their supply chain, who they're using to build, forcing them to make a plan, and then set goals around that. It's setting a level of intentionality about who they use to hire, especially as they're working in different communities and working towards benefiting communities. And so by doing that, you're creating this environment for where now we're creating new opportunities for folks by just people having to do the work, like, oh, wow, you know, and they start digging in. It's like, wow, we could do this a little bit better. I think the other side of it that's really important is it really gives the opportunity to set up to really collect the data and collect the information that we need to where down the road we can say, okay, now we see and we can diagnose this problem a little more accurately, and we can see where the pitfalls are to make sure that the build environment, especially when we're talking about the billions that our state is spending on affordable housing, where can we really use more policy solutions to make sure that that money is being spread out in a more equal way. And I think the other side of that, it's a win-win for the state, because if you have more folks, one of the issues around building homes and home building is that we don't necessarily have the workforce available to do the work to build the millions and millions of homes that we need to build. So it also encourages more growth in that department, while more equitable growth and offering other new people opportunity to uplift themselves in their communities. So it's kind of one of those no-brainer win-win types of situations, but we just have to, let's actually get it down on paper and move it forward. So it's exciting. It's exciting to see that we have this kind of opportunity to provide equity in a space that where we see so clearly it has not existed to this point.
Yeah, thanks, Constantine, for talking in depth about that. I'm really excited to see, you know, what the data brings and what can grow out of that data collection process.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I have a question that could be for any of you or all of you. Where does funding for this type of legislation come from? And why is it important for legislation like Measure J, ULA, and AB 2873 to be backed by a permanent source of financing or funding?
I love talking about money. I could talk about money if you want. So ULA in and of itself is a permanent funding source. When it gets implemented, it has no sunshine date. It goes on forever. But what's really important about that, particularly in the affordable and the development world, is that it provides certainty. So an affordable housing developer understands that there's going to be funding available from the city. So when they know that that's available, they're willing to take the risk associated with acquiring land and making the investment in all the pre-development functions, you know, hiring an architect to design what's going to get built there, start to work with the city on the entitlement and land use approvals. And that certainty is just a key component. And I think what you'll see is the city will start to ramp up and start doing affordable housing at scale. I can't not say, speaking to the California YIMBY bill, 2873, I think it's fantastic. And I wanted to just do a pitch on May the 9th at 10 o'clock, we're going to do a webinar with our developers to talk about implementation, because it is going to require a certain amount of thinking about doing business differently. And so we want to equip our members with as much information as possible and the community with as much information as possible about how to be really affirmatively looking to diversify the workforce that's building affordable housing.
Love that. Love that. I think that actually goes great with kind of what, you know, thinking about the importance of tying 2873 to funding, because it just provides that incentive when, you know, and Alan, I don't need to tell Alan how difficult it is to get a project, I mean, you know, built, especially an affordable housing project where you have to leverage so many different financial levers, planning. I mean, it's just the barriers to building are incredible in this state. And that's, you know, I mean, thankfully it helps us to have a job, but unthankfully folks are suffering. And it's unbelievable. And so to, when you're trying to have all those things to measure, it's important that we have some incentive to incentivize folks to say, okay, wait a minute, we need to have that intentionality. And the interesting thing is, in talking to developers, most of them want, it wasn't that they didn't want to do it. It's just when you're weighing about 10,000 different things and have about 6,500 hurdles to jump over, it's hard for that to come into your periphery, come through and be actionable. And so, you know, that's the real importance of it, is it really kind of incentivizes developers to say, hey, okay, we want to get this funding. Let's make sure that we're doing it. And actually, this is what we want to do anyway. And so, you know, big props to Alan and his folks and many others across the state that really want to do this. And now they have some better incentives that with the state stepping in to help make that a reality.
Thank you both. So I know we're running short on time, but I do want to fit in this last question, if you'll indulge me. So a lot of this work that you're doing, developing policies, bringing them through whatever system they need to get through, are unpaid due to, you know, just a lack of funding. You're doing coalition work. Are there models that your organizations have related to either partnering with agencies to support inclusive participatory engagement that also compensates impacted community leaders for their time and their attention that they're paying to developing these policies?
Well, I feel like for us at Pride and Truth, right? Pride and Truth was founded in 2020. So still a baby and growing. It does have a lot of attention because of the work that I've done before, you know, Pride and Truth was born. But we always, we're big on fundraising right now and just, you know, looking for to uplift the CBO. So we've been very fortunate to have like the Youth Justice Coalition uplifting Pride and Truth. So with that being said, being part of the Youth Justice Coalition Board of Directors and also helping with the legal department, where I can say that I really love the fact that they take pride in making sure the community members that engage get like a stipend or a gift card, or just always making sure that there is something for them, and also uplifting their work and just always being present on how we can help them as well.
I think for our organization, it's we don't engage necessarily directly at the community level, but we do engage more at community organization level. And so what we usually try to do is really lean in to bringing community-led organizations, specifically BIPOC-led and BIPOC-serving organizations, to really bring them together and uplift their voices in the process, making sure that that voice is part of the policy making that goes on, that our state electeds hear directly from them, through some of that, through convening our housing working group, and that they can communicate and talk about housing and the issues that are important to them, and uplift some of the bills that and policies that they are important for their constituents and the folks that they serve, so that they can, you know, others can hear and support and jump on and get behind some other great ideas that are generated from the communities. So we I think, you know, the important thing is it's not just hey, come hang out with us. It's actually putting muscle and teeth behind it and really finding ways that we can, you know, I, you so you, one of the great phrases is, you want to show me your value, show me your budget. We really do try to put actual budget behind these convenings and making it something that's actually where the outcome is going to be positive impact in those communities. And so that's something that's just really important for us, and that we really have tried to invest in the over the last few years, and to really making it happen. And the offshoot is opportunities like AB 2873 and other things that'll be coming out shortly this year as well. So it's been fruitful for us in really achieving that and achieving our values, and something that we're looking to continue to expand and do as much as we can going forward.
Yeah, just a real quick note on the funding. I'm not aware of anybody in the ULA coalition who was funded specifically to do the campaign or to put the measure together. So it was all kind of done within the context of our work plan anyway. So it was really just a matter of members of the coalition getting themselves organized in a way that they had personnel resources available to do the work. I will say that since Election Day, however, we've been looking for resources to help support the work on the implementation side, and we've been somewhat successful on that. So I think the theme that I would take out of that is that nothing breeds the ability to raise funds like success. So being out there in the community, working hard, and then being able to demonstrate that you can do the work makes the pitch a little bit easier. And then the last thing I'll say is that all that work is funded by, as I think, by philanthropic dollars. You know, the organizations are able to commit to work on things like that because of the philanthropic dollars.
Thank you all for answering my last question I snuck in there. So thank you all so much, Alan, Maria, and Constantine, for joining me in this conversation. Your insights are very essential in understanding how our daily experiences are impacted by public policy, and you all play a vital role in achieving complex policy outcomes from which we all benefit. So thank you for that. So if you'd like to learn more about how we support place-based initiatives for housing and economic development at LISP Los Angeles, please visit us at www.lisp.org/Los Angeles and follow us on Twitter at LISP_LA. You can find the rest of the series on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Subscribe to hear more conversations about the people and places that shape Los Angeles. This podcast was produced in collaboration with Ronell Hampton, founder of Growing Greatness Now. Growing Greatness Now is a consulting firm committed to social and environmental justice.